I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. A delightful book that's out now is The Boreal Gourmet, Adventures in Northern Cooking. It's a really great recipe book as well as a bit of a memoir about living and eating in the North. Michelle Genet is the author, and she joins me from her home in the Yukon to talk about life up north and northern cuisine. The Boreal Gourmet is published by Lost Moose, an imprint of Harbor Publishing. Michelle Genet will be in Vancouver this Thursday, the 3rd of June, at 6 p.m. They'll be serving up food from the book at Barbara Jo's Books to Cooks, and with the price of admission, you'll get a signed copy of the book. Go to bookstocooks.com for more information. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Michelle Genet. Good morning, Ms. Genet.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Very good. Yourself?
Good, thank you.
What's the weather up like in Whitehorse at the moment?
It's about 27 degrees.
Really?
And there are huge cumulonimbus clouds in the sky, and there are wasps buzzing everywhere. And the spruce tips are in bloom, and I just spent about half an hour up on the clay cliffs behind my house with my sister picking the first batch of spruce tips for the year, so I'm very excited.
Well, what are you picking, sorry?
They're spruce tips, and they're the first green bit that appears at the end of black spruce branches.
And then what do you use them for?
Oh, I use them for shortbread, for which there's a recipe in the book, and I put them in a dish called Delirious Goat, combined with preserved lemons, for a kind of Moroccan/Thai, kind of defies description, end result that's really, really yummy, using either people who don't live in the Yukon can use lamb. But here we can make that with either domestic goat, which somebody raises not far from downtown Whitehorse on the shores of Lake Lebarge, or with a Dall sheep if you were lucky enough to get it.
So you said it was 27 degrees. What's the temperature throughout the year? I guess it does get cold sometime, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty intense. We have very intense winters and very intense summers. Normally, the temperature in the winter can drop down to, in Whitehorse, to about 35 or 40, minus 35 or 40. And in the summertime, it can get to be 27, 28, sometimes over 30. So it's kind of, we live in a land of contrasts that are hard to imagine. When you're in the middle of one season, it's very hard to imagine the other season that you've just emerged from. But it's great that we have these intense summers, because they really kind of are an antidote for the 7 months winters that we live with customarily.
Now, the assumption, we have assumptions, I should say, about what the food is like up there, that it's sort of wild and gamey and the sort. Is it?
Well, I think, you know, that's a really good question, and it's interesting because just as people do in the South, we live from, the mainstay of our diet is supermarket food. But the great thing is that we can supplement our diet with berries and wild meat and wild fish, which are commonly known in the North as country foods, C-O-U-N-T-R-Y, which is kind of a nice old-fashioned term. And it really is, it's great to be able to go out and pick berries. I'm not a hunter, but of course I enjoy the bounty of what the hunters go out and get. And similarly, I'm a pretty bad fisher person, but I have lots of generous friends. But it's really kind of the cream of the crop. Those gorgeous wild foods are probably not present in enough bulk or number to form the basis of a diet. They really, although they did, of course, for Yukon First Nations peoples for thousands of years. I think that you know, collecting wild berries and actually being successful on a moose hunt is unpredictable. The yield is unpredictable. You never really know what you're going to get, so it can't be relied on as a major food source. But what it can be relied on for is a really lovely addition to the everyday diet.
Now, you said that most of the diet comes from supermarket food, like us in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Does it cost more?
It does cost a fair amount more. Everything has to be has to travel that extra 2,500 kilometers up the highway. And it the further north that you go, the more limited the selection becomes, and the more expensive it becomes, of course. But here in Whitehorse, we have quite a diverse population, and so our supermarkets are really well stocked with spices and ingredients from East Indian cuisine,
right,
and Philippine cuisine. We're really lucky in that way. We have quite a varied choice.
And fast food's influence, it's there, right?
Oh, yeah, there in a big way, yeah. KFC and A&W and McDonald's, and we also have big box stores on the outskirts of town, so...
I'm assuming as well, because of the cost and the sort that the people up north have to be self-sufficient. Do you do a lot of canning and preserving?
I do, yeah, I do. I don't have to. Most people who live in towns or in Whitehorse, the major center, don't really have to can, but it's so great. It's just such a fabulous thing to do, and the berries are unique, and it's just the most amazing feeling to have a freezer full of them and a cupboard full of high bush cranberries or blueberries or low bush cranberries that have been made into chutneys and jams and jellies and sauces. So because you can really dress up the everyday supermarket diet. Beef or lamb or anything that you buy in the store becomes much more northern tasting if it's combined with wild foods.
Now, what can't you grow there that you'd like to?
Oh, quite a bit. Herbs, I guess, are the biggest challenge, although people do grow them very successfully in greenhouses. And northerners are big gardeners. They're really into the garden. It's I think partly the influence of the long winter makes everybody crazy to get their hands into the dirt and start producing stuff. So there are a lot of greenhouses around town, and also quite a few communal gardens where people grow successfully chard, mm-hmm. cabbage, kale, that sort of thing, arugula, which is a real bonus, and tomatoes and those kinds of more delicate vegetables really do need to be in a greenhouse. So people do it, for sure. And there are also actually some really good market gardens here where people grow beets, potatoes, all the root vegetables, turnips, you know, beautiful, beautiful stuff. That's one thing about the North. Vegetables get quite big, partly because of the intensity of the growing season.
Yeah. Now, do you grow stuff year-round, say, at your house?
This year, for the first time, we had a little herb garden in the basement.
Yeah.
And that was really fun. That was great.
Yeah.
But normally not. I'm not a big gardener. But we're planning to get into that not this summer, but next summer. We'll probably join the Downtown Urban Gardener Society and get ourselves a little plot down the street, but also have a tiny greenhouse where we can grow especially things like basil and cilantro, so we can have pesto, a stock of pesto in the freezer.
Now, what struck me after reading the book is how relevant this book is to people in my part of the world. You found that quite easily, that you didn't have to be from the north to learn and eat like people in the north?
I did. Well, you know, the interesting thing is that I came up here as a vegetarian, so it took me a while to get tuned in to wild meat and salmon. But after I started eating those things again, then that whole world opened up to me, and I found it very, very exciting and very gratifying. But I did start to pick berries when I first moved up here, and I had never done that before in my life. I came from downtown Toronto, I think once on a canoe trip in Killarney. In late August, Killarney is a sort of Algonquin Park type area in Ontario. We picked wild blueberries, and it was a thrill. But up here, as soon as I moved here, I discovered that people do it all the time. And it took me a couple of years to really get tuned into it. It's not something that you can just do automatically. The berries, you have to get to know where they grow, and you have to get to know the kinds of places that you'll find them in, and you have to learn that they might not be there next year. You might have to find another place for them. And you know, the concept of going out into the woods and finding berries was just so alien to me when I first got here. But gradually, I learned that it is possible to go out into the bush and find food to eat, and I just found that thrilling.
Now, thinking about the berries that you'd find in the wild, and then in the book, there's a part, a section there about shaggy manes, which are, I guess, mushrooms that you find off the highway, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have to worry about whether what you're picking that's wild is poisonous?
Oh, absolutely.
And how do you? How can you tell? I'm just wondering.
Well, with mushrooms, I'm really cautious, and I only really recognize shaggy manes and morel mushrooms. And there are ways that I outline in the book to tell which are the safer ones and which aren't. And also, some people are quite sensitive to wild mushrooms, even if they're perfectly harmless. So there's always you always have to let people know that there's a wild mushroom in the dish that you're serving, just in case that they have a known sensitivity to wild mushrooms. But once you're confident that you do know mushrooms, and there are people here who are mushroom experts, then it's fairly easy to feel safe that you're picking the right thing. But, you know, always with the caveat that you have to be super cautious.
What also struck me about the book is that are the influences of other cuisines, say Mediterranean cuisine, Asian cuisine, Italian cuisine. And you do that quite well in the book by incorporating those sorts of sensibilities with what you have available in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And you tested, I guess, all these recipes. You created them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That must have been fun.
It was really fun. My friends and I, and also people that I didn't know very well, I would invite in because they were experts of one kind or another. We had a great time, and I would usually get the recipe to a point where I thought that it could be tested. And then I'd call in my friends, and we'd have tasting sessions, and we'd comment, and they'd write notes, and there would always, of course, be wine involved, and it was really, really fun. Some of the results of those tasting sessions meant that a recipe didn't get included in the book because it just didn't really say anything in particular. For example, I tried roasting vegetables in rosehip jam. And I just thought it was going to be fabulous. I think I had put carrots and beets and onions and tossed them all in rosehip jam and some birch syrup and a little bit of balsamic vinegar. And when the end result was completely unimpressive, and my friend said, nah, don't do it.
Yeah.
But then I pureed beet and carrot with rosehips, and that was totally different and was really successful. I don't know why. But there was something about the action of churning up the rose hips with the vegetables that created this really lovely, subtle dish that was also a fabulous color. And it's actually on the cover of the book, I think. Yes, it is, that particular dish. And it was great. And the taster said, yeah, thumbs up. You can do that one.
Yeah. Now, you talk in the book about your friend Phil. She's from Toronto, right?
Yes.
She's Italian.
Yes.
And I love the story in the book that you had some deadline to create these recipes, I guess, for a column or something like that.
That's right.
Yeah. And so the one thing that she talked about in the book, tomatoes in the wintertime.
Yeah.
We have that problem here in Vancouver. So
of course you do.
What do you do?
Well, we use canned tomatoes, but we don't use diced tomatoes. We just use them, whatever has gone through the least processing is the best, as Phil says, her brother advises her, because they haven't lost their flavor. And, you know, it's really interesting, I was just in Scotland, and the big news in Scotland amongst my husband's relatives was that carrots taste much better when they're cooked whole. So it was all the rage in Scotland 2 weeks ago to start cooking carrots whole, and then chopping them up afterwards, and it's kind of a no-brainer. But you know, every now and again, these things come up, and we realize that something really simple makes a lot of sense. And why didn't we think of it before? So the same is true of canned tomatoes. The smaller, the more processed the material, the more the taste has kind of evaporated.
And you bake a lot of bread?
You know, Joel, I became a baker in the writing of this book.
Yeah.
And I learned all about sourdough for this book, and it was quite a journey. And now I'm a delighted, convinced sourdough bread maker, and I would never go back to commercial yeast except as an augmenter now and again. Sourdough has been a revelation.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter in the book where Michelle goes through making sourdough bread, and it's just, I mean, I'm not a bread maker, nor do I have the inclination to start, but mm-hmm. it's just fascinating to read how this comes about and how you do it and the sort. Can you go through you call it sourdough boot camp, right?
Yeah.
What's the 14 days? I mean, is that, I guess,
can
you explain that? Yeah.
Yeah, that is, the 14 days is growing a starter from a tiny bit of flour and a tiny bit of warm water and getting it to the point where it will raise a loaf of bread on its own. The sourdough boot camp basically follows the process that I went through as I was trying to build my starter. And I didn't know what I was doing. I was being guided by cookbooks and by various blogs on the internet. And I discovered after about 4 days that my start, and when I tried to make some sourdough buttermilk cinnamon buns, that my sourdough didn't have nearly the strength to actually act as the sole leavener for something, a project that big. So what I started to do was find recipes that used sourdough for flavoring and another leavening agent to really get the rise that you're looking for in baked goods. And as I was learning how to work with sourdough for those products like sourdough scones or English muffins, I was continuing to feed my starter every day. So it was strengthening as I was learning. And so it was strengthening. I was strengthening, in a way, with my sourdough skills. And by the end of the period of time, and it took much longer than 14 days, it was, over a period of months, I was confident enough to use my sourdough for the first time, my sourdough starter for the first time, and it produced a beautiful piece of bread. But it took me a lot of stops and starts to actually get there, so the 14 days are my experience condensed, and I've built a starter. Since then, I've built a starter successfully in 14 days by following this method, and ended up with this beautiful starter that is just ready to go after 6 or 7 hours of its feeding. So it was a really interesting process, and both the first sort of experiment, and then the successful 14-day boot camp that I went through, and it has landed me in a place where I can actually treat the sourdough starter quite cavalierly, and it still comes back and keeps producing fabulous bread. And I'm so excited about it. I want other people to go through the same experience. I've started to give the sourdough out to my friends, and so they're experimenting with it, and they're having as much fun as I am, and it's kind of magic. It's a kind of a magic process.
Yeah, it just sounds fun reading it. The other thing, one reviewer said of the book, the way that I guess the publishers have made the book is that you can open the book at any page and it lies flat out, and I have to say that. For any book, whether it's a recipe, especially a recipe book, I mean, it's great that it does that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about that from the very beginning with the publishers and I, and I asked my brilliant editor, Anna Comfort, if we could organize the binding so that would happen. And she said, oh, yes, that's not a problem at all. And I was thrilled to discover when I got the first copy in my hands that it lies flat and the pages turn really easily.
Yeah.
And it's a real bonus in the kitchen when you've got your hands covered in dough and you can just turn a page with the tip of a little finger, and it's so it's a really, it's a convenient working document.
Yeah, and the spine's not bent either, so that's it sits nice on the shelf. I'm sure a lot of people will get the pages dirty over the years, because this is a book that, you know, that people up north will have, and I'm sure down south as well. It's a charming book, Michelle, and I appreciate the conversation today.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. I think just in closing, I'd like to add that one of the things about the book is that it looks really nice, and that's it's very clean, and that's partly because of photographer Kathy Archbold's fabulous photos.
Right.
And my friend Laurel Perry's
the doodles. Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are funny to look at as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations and continued good luck with the book, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Joe. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Michelle Genet will be appearing at Barbara Jo's Books to Cooks this Thursday, the 3rd of June at 6 p.m. The ticket's price will get you into the reception with the author, a signed copy of the book and food from the book, bookstocooks.com. Check that out for more information on the event. The book is called The Boreal Gourmet, Adventures in Northern Cooking. Lost Moose is its publisher. That's an imprint of Harbor Publishing. Its author, Michelle Genet, on the line from Whitehorse in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.